discovery of London. That's London Walks Distilled. London Walks makes the new familiar, and the familiar new. That's London Walks opened out like the petals of a rose. This is the London Walks podcast. Sure enough, it's a discovery of London that makes the new familiar and the familiar new. Like London Walks, the podcast is a potpourri and a many-stringed instrument. Every day, there's a Today in London History Bulletin. Friday's a doubleheader, the London History Bulletin and the weekly podcast. Everything from interviews to readings by the two London Walks guides who are professional narrators, to Helena Jones's brilliant analyses of famous paintings, to extracts from London Walks tours, to retrospectives and look-aheads. All done to the London Walks gold standard. Take you places you wouldn't have found off your own bat, show you things you wouldn't have seen, tell you things you didn't know. Make the new familiar and the familiar new. Change the way you see London. Okay, that's the ringing of the tocsin and the writing on the greeting card. Let's see what's in the box today. London Calling.
It's February 25th, so the only thing for it is to read that Auden poem. And yes, goes without saying, there are a couple of anachronisms. What's more, I'm going to edit it slightly. Change just a couple of words. Here's how it goes. Here's the only way you can start a Today in London History podcast if today is February 25th. Stop all the clocks. Cut off the telephone. Prevent the dog from barking with a juicy bone. Silence the pianos and with muffled drum bring out the coffin. Let the mourners come. Let airplanes circle moaning overhead, scribbling on the sky the message, he is dead. Put crepe boughs round the white necks of the public doves. Let the traffic policemen wear black cotton gloves. He was our north, our south, our east and west, our working week and our Sunday rest, our noon, our midnight, our talk, our song. I thought that he would last forever. I was wrong. The stars are not wanted now. Put out everyone. Pack up the moon and dismantle the sun. Pour away the ocean and sweep up the wood. For nothing now can ever come to any good. Well, yes and no. He died on February 25th, 1723. But I think he will live forever. Or near enough to forever. And nothing now can ever come to any good? No, that's not true. We can come to good, go to good, in Greenwich, and Chelsea, and the West End, and Lincoln, and Windsor, and Longleat in Wiltshire, and Appleby Magna in Leicestershire, and Oxford, and Cambridge, and Hampton Court, and Kensington, and Westminster, and all over the City of London. Okay, I've pretty well given the game away, haven't I? Christopher Wren. Sir Christopher Wren died 299 years ago today, February 25th, 1723. And he lives on in all of those wonderful buildings. Wonderful buildings in that great long list of special English places he graced and blessed. This is one of those podcasts it's impossible not to do, despite my vow that for the most part I'd give the achingly obvious anniversaries a miss, go for the arcane and undiscovered as opposed to rounding up the usual suspects. But it is simply impossible to hopscotch to February 25th and not pay your respects to Christopher Wren. Not in a London podcast, at any rate. Tell you what, though. I'll steer it down some of the byways of his life. A few of the particulars that aren't very well known. For the big, glaringly obvious stuff, you don't need me. You can Wikipedia away to your heart's content. So here are a few of the byways of Christopher Wren's life and death. He was born in Wiltshire, but he had London roots. His paternal grandfather was a London mercer. The Wrens believed they came originally from Denmark. Thank you very much, Denmark. He was the kind of sickly child who survives into robust old age. We think he went to Westminster School. I say as much on my old Westminster walk when we visit the school. But no one's absolutely certain that he did. When he was a 10-year-old, he wrote a New Year message for his father in Latin verse and prose. 3 or 4 years later, he's a young teenager. He devised a project for hand-signing alphabets for deaf people. From that, he's still a youngster, remember? He moved on to designing what he called a pneumatic engine, what we'd call an air pump, and then a pasteboard star calendar, and then when he was 16, a satyricon to plot equal hours from a sundial, and then a device for writing in the dark, and then a recording weather clock, and then a pasteboard calculator for the orbit of the moon. As an Oxford undergraduate, Christopher Wren designed a box beehive and a practical hygrometer. I have to confess, I didn't know what a hygrometer was. Now I do. It was an instrument used to measure the amount of water vapor in air, in soil, or in confined spaces. And onwards and upwards, some undergraduate this young man was. He did work on graphite for lubricating timepieces, invented a mechanical corn drill, and a regulating weather clock recording temperature and wind direction, and an egg incubator, and a demonstration model of an eye with a translucent retina. And he worked on a theory of elastic impact from the collision of balls suspended by threads. He worked on respiration and the vital principle of air, a subject not fathomed until the discovery of oxygen over 100 years later, and on tracking comets. And all of that was before he turned his mind to architecture. Was this a bright young man, think you? Yes, you got it. His was a noble, generous, and omnivorous mind. Isaac Barrow, a contemporary, described him as once a prodigy of a boy, now a miracle of a man, nay, even something divine. Christopher Wren's motto was numero pondera et mensura, by weight, number, and measure. Elegantly simple and profound. And maybe a bit now about his domestic life and his death. Wikipedia makes the point that Christopher Wren lived to be over 90 years old, and of those years, he was married only 9. He married twice. Faith Wren died of smallpox when they'd been married just 6 years. His second wife, Jane Wren, died of tuberculosis. They'd only been married 3 years. They're buried alongside each other in the chancel of St. Martin in the Fields. I didn't know that. I was glad to find it out. We don't know much about Faith and Jane, but we do have a love letter Wren wrote to Faith. It's delightful. It goes like this. I have set your watch at last and envy the felicity of it, that it should be so near your side and so often enjoy your eye. But have a care for it. For I have put such a spell into it that every beating of the balance will tell you 'tis the pulse of my heart, which labors as much to serve you and more truly than the watch. For the watch, I believe, will sometimes lie and sometimes be idle and unwilling. But as for me, you may be confident I shall never. And Christopher Wren's own end, on this day, 299 years ago? He was living in St. James's Street. The story goes that he would often go the couple of miles east to London to pay unofficial visits to St. Paul's to check on the progress of my greatest work. On one of those trips, he was 90 years old, remember? He caught a chill. It took hold. Pneumonia, I suppose. On February 25th, he took a nap and never woke up. A servant tried to wake him up. Christopher Wren was dead. For the rest, well, everyone knows about the modest burial place in the crypt of St. Paul's, and the Latin inscription over it that reads, "Reader, if you seek a monument, just look around you." Otherwise, sure, why not do some further reading off your own bat if you want? Be sure to track down the wonderful story about the height of the columns at Windsor Castle. I very much like the tale about someone asking him why an architectural feature that couldn't be seen with the naked eye had to be done to perfection. And Wren said, "Because God sees it." For me, though, the Pole Star story is highly personal. It's something that happened to me on the 11th of September, 2001. Yes, 9/11. Like everyone else, I was reeling. The world had tilted. And something came welling up out of my subconscious. It was something I'd read years earlier, read and forgotten. Well, I thought I'd forgotten. I hadn't. For some reason, I found myself thinking about St. Paul's. Surely it was because of the horrors visited upon London by the Luftwaffe in World War II, and St. Paul's somehow coming through, surviving. That famous photograph of the city in flames, and St. Paul's, defiant, intact, beautiful, seen through the flames and clouds of black smoke. And what that sight, their beautiful cathedral, storm-tossed but seaworthy, meant to Londoners. And suddenly, there it was. Something I'd remembered that I didn't know I'd remembered. Something I needed. Something that steadied me, comforted me, came to me in my hour of need. I don't know who said it, but here's what he said. Just one annotation. The author uses the word specific in an old-fashioned way, a specific being a remedy, a medicine. Here it is. St. Paul's is much more than a place of worship. It's a specific against grossness, brutality, and despair. Okay, peroration time. Find you a find, catch you a catch. I've done so. I've found a long-lost image that effectively positions all of Wren's creations on the acres surrounding St. Paul's. It's an astonishing vista. John O'Hara said on the death of George Gershwin, "Duke Ellington is dead. I don't have to believe it if I don't want to. Christopher Wren is dead, but I don't believe it." And that illustration, those buildings and structures, they show me that I'm right. Christopher Wren lives. And the other astonishing thing about getting them all together in a single view is you realize no other country in the world had a Christopher Wren. No other city in the world had a Christopher Wren. Whew. What a week this has been. Sabrina's 41-inch bust and Dorothy Padgett's aversion to the color green and Protein Man Stanley Green and the saving of the Northern Heights and the Chelsea Arts Ball and now Sir Christopher Wren. Another week going to top this one? Well, we'll see, but I somehow doubt it. Surfing the waves of this week, I've been reminded again and again of something my best American pal, another David, said to me years ago. Aside here, I hope Central Park's treating you well this morning, David. He said, "England, it's a question of texture. The texture is so much more interesting, so much richer. You can travel a great long distance in the States before you get much in the way of a change. It's hundreds of miles of very nice cornfields. But England, the texture of the place is changing all the time. You go around the next bend and there's something different, something interesting. And that's even more the case in London. Here, it's not just mosaics of texture variations. It's varying textures stacked on top of each other. Less lust through less protein, and more lust through Sabrina's bust, and no lust for horsey Dorothy, who never kissed a male until she kissed Golden Miller, and he was a gelding, and Oscar Wilde in police court with an anarchist who emptied a revolver at the House of Commons, and debutantes blushing and dowagers blanching at the Chelsea Arts Ball, and the Northern Heights being saved, and Christopher Wren lives. That's the London wave I've surfed this week. I'll take it. Good night from the world's most stimulating city. See you tomorrow.